This episode of Backstory is brought to you by WizCon. WizCon is a 1,000-attendee feminist intersectional science fiction convention in Madison, Wisconsin. And this year, WizCon is leveling up its gaming. From our evening tabletop games to our panel format gaming discussions, they would love to have new friends from the gaming community join their party. For more information, visit WizCon.net or follow the link in the show notes. Hello, heroes. This is Backstory. And I am obviously not Alex Roberts. Alex had some of the weirdest audio corruption that I have ever heard this week. And unfortunately, she was away from her recording gear, so she wasn't able to correct it on her own. So instead of your regular hostess, I'll be introing the episode. Don't worry, none of the audio from the interview itself was damaged. And I am particularly happy about that because Alex is talking to one of my all-time favorite designers this week, Emily Kerr-Boss. Emily is well known for her groundbreaking work in romantic roleplay. She designed Breaking the Ice, Shooting the Moon, and Under My Skin, which were recently revised and collected into the beautifully bound Romance Trilogy. You can find that and more of Emily's work over at blackandgreengames.com. But for now, let's sit back, relax, and learn more about Emily with Alex.
Now, I'm weirdly feeling a little nervous, but I'm really excited to talk to you.
Oh, yay. Good. Well, let's jump right into talking about the Romance Trilogy, actually. I was just leafing through it earlier today, and it, like, this book feels like a labor of love. Where did the idea of bringing these all together and making them into one big, beautiful thing come from?
I think it sort of started at the beginning, and then was just this dream that lingered around forever and ever. And, you know, at certain points you go, will I ever really do that?
Yeah.
When I first wrote the Breaking the Ice, the reason why I ended up writing three games was because it was just a two-player game, and some friends played it, and they had an odd number of people in their party. And so this question was, what do we do if we have a two-player game? And we have an odd number of people. So I said, oh, well, why don't I write a three-player game that can be a companion to that? And then people could play either game or have mixed, you know, two and three. And then later I figured out that Breaking the Ice actually works well if you, like, team up, or you could have double dates, or there's a lot of different ways that you can make it have more than two players. But I didn't know that then. And then it grew into a trilogy when I realized that I could make a larger game with Under My Skin. And I always really wanted to have them together. And I remember working on them. I published Breaking the Ice and then Shooting the Moon back to back, sort of one year and then the next. And it took a few years to do Under My Skin. And I thought, okay, well, eventually I'll get them together. And it just took 10 years, a little more than that.
And a lot happened in those 10 years. I mean, when I think about the context in which the original Breaking Ice would have been received and the context in which this trilogy is received, like, it's just a completely different milieu.
Yeah, the world is completely different now. And I actually had to revise the language. Mm-hmm. You know, there were things that at the time when I wrote Breaking the Ice in 2005 were a little edgy, having gay characters as examples. Now it's like, that representation's not quite right. That fit like post-90s lesbians, but is totally not, like, that isn't the way you would talk about folks today. So letting the language match more categorizations and larger, more enlightened views of gender, and, you know, it really helped me realize that the games were really pushing the envelope for a lot of people's comfort and for culture at the time. I live in Massachusetts. It's a total bubble. Mm-hmm. I went to college in the Pioneer Valley, which people call the Happy Valley. And, you know, my one of my first jobs after college, my boss is a lesbian and the couple had two kids, and always on the outside was, well, this is how it is here for us. And that's not how it is in the rest of the world, in the rest of the country. And in that time period of playing these games and running these games, sort of miraculously things happened, like gay marriage came around and became something that was acceptable in the whole country, that was upheld by the Supreme Court, which was stunning. I didn't expect to see that in my lifetime. And the games fit within that under my skin sort of highlights that it's not necessarily a game that deals with polyamorous issues, but it was certainly written in, from my experiences with that world, and allowing space for that and being very inclusive about it. So it was interesting to see. And not that the polyamory is accepted in the mainstream, but I think that people just have a really different relationship with different types of lives and in a good way. Yeah.
So Under My Skin is the only one in the trilogy I haven't played. And when I heard a description, I was like, oh, cool, a game about polyamory. That's really interesting. I'd like to play that. And then I go and read it and I'm like, oh, this isn't 100% that though. This isn't about like a bunch of poly characters, like negotiating using like really familiar terms that I would know. It's just about people who are falling in love with each other in inconvenient ways that they didn't expect. Yeah.
Exactly. And you can set it within a poly context.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can say, what is being negotiated here isn't, oh, we only have one relationship at a time.
Yeah.
But how do we have more than one relationship if that's what we're going to embark on? And can we be honest and communicative and compassionate and loving in places where we feel most vulnerable?
Mm-hmm.
And probably most of the games that I've played have been in the more heteronormative context. There, the characters are operating within that. But it's been wonderful to be able to play games where that wasn't the norm. And it's really interesting seeing, I mean, honestly, that game is one of my favorite to run.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel just tremendously privileged to be present with people who are engaging with those kinds of issues. And because one of the things I think that makes it feel very opening is that the characters, you start creating them by creating this core issue that's something that they are struggling with, either in how it helps or distances them from others or that they've been hurt around. And then you create this character around it who has, you know, relationships and a life, and you just see a few moments from their life that are moments of great change or struggle and not change, but allowing them to recognize what they have in the relationships that exist. And just something about that just creates the space for players to go deep. And I'm grateful for that. I'm always grateful people are like, yeah, let's do that. That sounds fun.
I know what you mean, though, where you're like, okay, you guys are really going to do this with me. another thing that's interesting about Under My Skin is that it really doesn't, like, it really truly takes place in the real world. However, some of the hacks that are in this new version take it in all kinds of interesting directions. There's like a werewolf one. Have you gotten what has playing the werewolf hack of Under My Skin been like?
There's a few of the hacks that I have written, but I haven't gotten to play myself yet because they are within my realm of understanding the way that they're going to run. So it made sense to just put them out there. And the In the Arms of the Pack, that one is one that I wrote and I'm going to play more. But I've gotten to see it. I've heard from folks who have run it a couple of times that it sounds like it's a interesting and but lighter experience. It also doesn't focus on the sex and the fidelity and emotional relationships between two people in the same way. It takes it so you're really focusing on the pack. And the characters are people who are insiders and together and belong, or maybe who are breaking out because they want to rebel from this group, or they want to break in or being introduced to the group. So it's about identity and belonging in a moment when externally and internally this group is dealing with pressures. And actually, I think that that's actually what's going on in a lot of ways in Under My Skin. It's just that's not the focus of it. The focus of it is on, okay, you're in these probably couple relationships. There might be more, but, and then you're seeing how the dynamics of those relationships interact with a larger social circle that connects everybody. And in this one, the focus was on the social circle to see how it would blow up in your face or how it would bring people together when there's, you know, if you're werewolves and people have figured out that you're living near this town. Okay, you're being assaulted by the mortals from the village, and also the your great hunter is trying to overthrow the leader of the pack. What do you do?
Okay, the other under my skin hack that I want to ask you about is Erkanlan, which is the Arthurian hack, right? This one and the version of Breaking the Ice where you're telling a creation myth feel like the sort of most like abstracting of the games. Have you heard from people, like, did you get a chance to playtest either of those? And have you heard from people who've played them?
I ran the myth one, the Sun and Moon, many times. And that one, I really enjoyed taking it to exactly that. It's a really abstracted version of Breaking the Ice. So instead of playing humans who are falling in love or not, you're playing these like primordial beings who mythically were there at the beginning of all things, and using the structure of going back and forth and taking turns and introducing elements. And actually colors are sort of a thematic element that runs through. So at first there's only two colors. Like if it's the sun and moon, maybe it'd be silver and gold. And then you could introduce a new color. And maybe it's blue for this drop of water that becomes the world that the beings, the moral beings live on. And that one, it's also diceless too, because it relies more on a yes and principle rather than feeling like you need to decide, oh, how does that go? It's you're making moves back and forth like a dance. And then this world gets created within these three acts, basically. And you even introduce sort of emotions that the primordial beings feel, like rage. So that introduces this other sort of textural flavor of the world. Like before rage was felt, no one that wasn't in the world. And what does that feel like? Or love, or longing. And Erkanlan, I'm going to run it at Breakout Con.
Hooray! Oh, awesome.
Which is just coming up. Boy, is that next week?
Oh, it's literally next week. Yeah.
And that one was a real pleasure to write. I'd always thought that Under My Skin fit really well with that Arthurian intertanglement of relationships. Shooting the Moon, the second game, which is a love triangle, that's actually one of the go-to settings that seems suited to, because you have Arthur and Lancelot and Guinevere, so there's this love story at the heart of this nation. But using Under My Skin allows more of the sort of drama to unfold. I think that playing it in Shooting of the Moon, which is a tabletop game, it's more about, you know, the adventures and also focuses just on those three characters. Having the Under My Skin allows you to welcome in Merlin, and in this version, because, oh, there are so many versions of the Arthurian.
Yeah.
It's like just this incredible, like, Prometheus that changes form as you look at it in each different period. It's had context and meaning in so many different ways, and it's pretty wonderful having a myth that still is interpreted and reinterpreted in this meaning. And so in this particular version, I had that Merlin is in love with Arthur also, but it's unrequited.
Mm-hmm.
And Elaine, who or Nimue, is in love with Merlin, you know, and we have Mordred and Morgaine. Mordred is in love with Guinevere, which is actually part of some of the myths. So in this, it ends up wrapping up the fate of the country that gets torn apart by these loving relationships, which go so horribly wrong. And also, it's fun because we get to have the quests, where in between these intense emotional scenes that move the plot along, you can have the knights go out on quests. And that's a little bit inspired by games like my husband Ipadaya Ravishal's Swords Without Master, where it's there's a particular part of that game called the Rogues Phase, where people ask each other, so, when we were beset by the giant army of Ant-Man, how was it that you were able to take them all out and save us all? And then someone gets to say how their rogue, their adventurer, saved everyone by calling down the gods and smiting them from the earth, or saying how they struggled for days and we had this position and they overran us, but at the end we were able to escape. And so the quests will be like that, where it's people just in very summary form being able to create these epic moments in between the courtly drama.
Right, right. And that's interesting to design a game with phases like that. I see that a lot, where you know that certain kinds of gaming are intense or maybe draining, and certain kinds of things are like energizing, or certain kinds of things are like a bit low energy, and then the other things are high energy. Like, are you kind of consciously playing with player energy when you're thinking about the structure of a design?
Yeah, I try to, because it is really important. You're right. If you just have it go nonstop forever, then you're going to burn out your players. in Under My Skin, it's actually in the rules, I guess, that you take a break after you do all the character creation, and then you consciously come back and start the in-character play. And I don't know how many people, when they're playing it, feel like that's a rule, or just, oh yeah, this is time, let's run and take a break. But as far as I'm concerned, it's really kind of critical, because there's just this different mood and tempo for when you're doing the character creation, and it's team building, and it's allowing people to do a little bit of storytelling together, but in an intimate, very abstract way. And then you go apart, and then you come back together, and having taken that break just gives you a moment to put yourself into a different mind space and then move in to what you're doing. And actually, In the Arms of the Pack, one of the rules there is that you do a little bit of an exercise that allows you to raise your energy. It's called fizzing. And can I tell you an anecdote about where this came from?
Yes, please, because I can tell that even over audio, I can tell you're about to laugh, so yes.
It came out of a campaign playtest that I was doing with Becky Slitt, Hannah Schaefer, and Evan Rowland, who live in my area. Evan and Hannah published Questlandia, which is really fun world building, and you create a world at a crisis point and see what happens. And they wanted to make a campaign version of that, which I think they're going to kickstart sometime soon. And so we got to have the wonderful pleasure of trying that out with them. And in this game, we had a setting where it was like a multi-generational colony ship from Earth that had gone out and went to another planet. And so we made up, okay, so what were these people like? And, you know, how did they live, you know, on this ship for all these years? And so we decided they were very process-oriented, like consensus. And everybody kind of had, like, psychological training and, you know, just really, like, touchy-feely and totally polyamorous because, you know, you didn't want envy and just, you know, very, like, utopian in a lot of ways. Or it felt very Hampshire and Pioneer Valley and Massachusetts-y, too. And so then we got to see how did that really work out. And yeah. And then on this new planet, how it went terribly wrong with all that was going on. But so as we were just playing, we would make up little bits of the institutions and the social mores that they had created. And one of them was fizzing, which is being physical with someone, particularly if you're angry with them, as a way to realign your energy with them.
Wow.
So like playing some kind of sport, you know, like... I don't know. Probably business people do this with squash. I bet that's a thing.
I always feel like those like early morning tennis games or whatever those like business people do. It's like there's something very deeply psychological going on there.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. And I think I really love martial arts. I've done Aikido at times and Taekwondo a long time ago. And there's something really bonding about sparring with people. That's hard to describe if you haven't done it because, oh, it looks very violent on the outside, but these traditions very much, many of them are about centering and spirit and joining with other people, even though what you're doing has a violent effect. When you're actually practicing it with your colleagues, that isn't the way you're entering into it. You're entering into it with love and caring. so that you're helping each other learn about your physicality, and it's a real gift. So that's what sort of went into fizzing. And so, anyway, when I was writing the romance trilogy, I had, you know, all this time last year, every spare moment last year, to spend thinking about what else, you know, what other little things could be included. And so fizzing, I decided to add it as a technique because there might be certain games where it's fun to do something physical or emotional, or, and I'm, it's like just a icebreaker or warm up, right? I mean, I think that's what a lot of group building warm ups do. And so for In the Arms of the Pack, you start out with something like that. So like maybe you all howl together and it's just a fun moment and it's a little physical, or you use your voice and your body, and it helps you step into the space. So, that was something that was fun. And I particularly liked it because it came out of a fictional world into the real world.
Bringing stuff from other practices is really interesting to me. Like when you were talking about martial arts, I talk to people all the time who are like, oh yeah, I knit and I thought about knitting when I was working on this design, or like I make cabinets and my cabinetry came into this, or like my music. I love that stuff. What else are you bringing to the table, so to speak, when you design something? What inspires you?
Well, I was in therapy for 9 years.
That'll help.
That really helps. And I think a lot of that thought and went into the romance trilogy in particular, and just the Under My Skin in particular is a lot of, you know, it calls upon analysis of relationships and emotions and feelings, and also just my normal stupid life insurance experiences of like falling in love or, you know, having terrible breakups and, you know, and all those horrible, wonderful things that particularly happened in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And when I hit 30, I was like, oh, I'm 30. Oh my God, but I never have to be in my 20s again.
Yeah, people try to reassure me when I use the term pushing 30. I'm like, no, I'm pushing hard. you know, it's funny that you mentioned therapy. I mean, do you think that either making or being in games can have a therapeutic component?
Well, I think that's an interesting question and one to answer carefully.
Yeah.
Because absolutely I do. And also, it's not therapy. you know, there's so many different ways that I think it's very valuable for the individual to be able to have room and space to explore different consciousnesses, different ways of exploring, inhabiting the universe, different people's viewpoints. You know, you get that when you're playing with other people because there's something magically full about role playing, or can give you so much information about how other people view the world, whether it's just, oh my God, I never would have thought of attacking that castle from that angle or going through the sewers. Like, how did you think of that? To playing with someone and seeing what their insights are about human relationships or grief. And authors have that opportunity to share their view in just this incredibly elaborate way. You know, all artists communicate, and it seems to me, maybe I'm writer-centric, but just having access to words that can describe the internal spaces of people, landscapes that don't exist, just the full panoply of what our imaginations can hold is incredibly freeing. And role-playing, holy cow, we can do that with one another at the table, on the spot, anywhere we want, anything we can imagine. It's so powerful. It's not limited by technology. It's not limited by anything except our hopes and fears and, you know, like our trust at the table and whatever, you know, systems that we choose. So that's this amazing hologram type like unit that we can plug into. And so in terms of our personal care and our learning and our development as human beings, that's a really profoundly powerful thing. And then here we are at the table with people that we know or we don't know. Maybe they're our friends, but maybe they don't feel like being in a space where they need to be an emotional support for someone who's having a very strong negative experience. because maybe they're also in a space where they're having issues or aren't able to engage or need to do that in a way that's feels safe for them. So, you know, when I was in counseling and therapy, that was with someone who was a trained professional who was there, who had made a commitment, and I had made a commitment to them. And it was, you know, we knew what the context was of our interactions, and it was confidential, completely confidential. You know, and the way that I look at therapy is that it's, again, it's this creating a container for someone to explore themselves and to learn about what exactly they've gone through in the world and how it's affected them and how they can find tools to help themselves steer through the future and heal through whatever it is that they are surviving. And that is, it's really powerful, but it's very intense and deep and sacred, you know. Gaming, I think, is an area where you can imbibe in some of the healing waters of therapy and therapeutic actions, but it isn't a context in which you have the full scope of confidentiality and training to be able to actually help someone cope with the hardest parts. So, so for example, the way that I try to approach games is to provide space for people to dip in, but then create a container that isn't going to overwhelm people with things from other people that they aren't expecting to buy into. You know, your social contract at a game is different than your social contract at a group, a support group, or a therapy session. And in Under My Skin, for example, I include a bunch of things that you do before you play, particularly if you're playing with people that you don't know well, where you ask everyone to talk a little bit about just who you are. You say who, you know, your name and what your real world relationship status is. And if you want, you can share a little more about your experience of relationships. You know, and I, as a, both as a game designer and game runner and as the writer of the game, I always make sure to share as much as I can about who I am to set the stage for the other participants to know that I am going to make it safe for people to express who they are. Mm-hmm. That's the commitment I'm making. And then people can say as little or as much as they want. And that is important in that game because you do go emotionally very deep and you're playing characters having strong emotional experiences with one another. So it's actually really helpful just to know, okay, this person's married, they're monogamous. We're playing polyamorous characters that are in love and dealing with all this stuff. But I do know in the real world that this other set of rules applies to their life. So I can have a little bit of space mentally from that. And the game, getting back to sort of the more therapeutic ideas of it, you're invited to create a core issue for your character as you create it that relates to something that has meaning for you in your life. And that can mean something that you struggle with. It doesn't have to, though. It can be maybe you have a parent who has dealt with, you know, honesty issues or anger issues. And then you can create a character who has that as one of the issues. You're not creating another person in your life to play, but you're creating a character that carries some of those elements so that you can have some insight. You can interact with it in a simulated, safe way because it's something that begins and ends. It's under your control. You can always step back from the experience. You have the GM and the other players as your resources to help you contain the experience or move away from it. But what that does is it allows everyone privately to have a little like sandbox for their emotions. And it's nested within this fictional play that everyone is engaging in, that everyone is coming together with. That character, like we're all writing characters in a book together, is something that everyone gets to experience, and they get to see how these emotions and these issues play out within the context of relationships or in jobs and, you know, whatever else comes up in the game. but no one else is signing on to be your therapist. They're not signing on to help you process the issues that come up, except in the context of, we want to make sure that this experience is going to be safe and comfortable for everybody. So if we find it getting too much, we'll step back. If people want to talk, you know, there's space for that. No one has to, but instead of it being, okay, let's all bring our worst baggage and we're going to make characters that are like it. And then we're going to like play them and or play a version of yourself. That's absolutely, I encourage people to write those games if they are making it clear that that's what people are signing on to, so they can opt out if that's not what they want. Or, you know, maybe make sure that that's something that's happening within the context that, you know, people who are running the game understand how to deal with those issues as they come up. I don't know. I'm not gonna say what other people can or cannot do, because that's not my place. But for me, what felt best and safest and strongest was to create the space for people to do it on their own within the play. And then if they wanted to talk about it afterwards, there's space for that. But it doesn't have to be something that people while they're playing need to buy into or do. It's not group therapy. It's art, right? That allows us to engage our emotions and thoughts and then see what we do with them.
Yeah. And yep, see what happens, right? Play to find out what happens, like everyone says. A lot of people, when they hear about games that require that kind of vulnerability, some people really balk at that. And I'm sure you've encountered that many times. The people who are just like, well, I could never play that with my group, or that would just never fly with the people that I game with. I think some of that is like, yeah, you probably shouldn't play that with that group, or like, yeah, you should just wait for the right people. But I don't know, are there ways to build trust? Are there ways to prepare people to play games like this, or to help people who might be interested maybe become more invested in it?
I think one of the places where I've embraced that is to allow there to be more distancing, or I think that's the wrong word, but more fictional space in order for people to indulge in emotions. So it's a lot, like you're saying, Under My Skin takes place in this world, our contemporary social world. It's people that you might meet. It's, you know, might even be sort of inspired by people you know. It's very intimate. It's dealing with issues like marriage and romance, you know, that are all things that we actually deal with. So having some kind of fictional layer that allows you to engage with it more as a fantastic world, I think it allows a lot of people to have the space to have emotions without it having to be their emotions. So it's a step towards that. And writing, you know, things like In the Arms of the Pack, it's a step towards that. You're playing werewolves who are having deep emotions. or there are games like Anna Besterling's Growing Up, which is a G-form game where you play out the events of Sense and Sensibility, the great Jane Austen novel. It's very straightforward and simple. You just are playing the characters and you go through scenes that are short summaries of what happens throughout the book. And you can have a pretty strong emotional reaction, and you're just, it's like you're reading a book together and playing out a few scenes from it. But it's not as punchy in your face as, all right, we're going to play characters that are falling in love with the wrong person and they're, you know, breaking up. And it's, there's this novel that sort of ties it together. People might already have some connection with by watching a movie or reading a book. And it allows people to dip their toe in, see if they like it.
Right.
I think there's different cultural contexts too. I mentioned G-form, and that's this pan-Nordic and international movement that from the mid-2000s. That was just a group of folks who were writing short, sharp, simple LARPs that dealt with real-world issues, a lot of them. And they did it reacting to a lot of LARPs where there was a lot of costumes and worlds that, you know, there were fantastic worlds and there were dragons to fight. And so they had certain strictures where things like no dragons. It wasn't a rule, but it was a value. We're not going to have fantastic elements. We're going to, like, real world stuff. And in that context, they needed to create space so that was even acceptable. Why even play in the real world? We live in the real world, many people might say. I certainly got that for Under My Skin, rather Breaking the Ice, when I first put it out. I literally had one person say to me, why would I want to play a game about dating when I can just go and date people?
Which, you know.
I mean, I'm not going to argue with that, absolutely. It's not always that easy, of course. You can't just, like. Although that was before the day of Tinder and Grindr.
That's true. Maybe it was less exhausting, or maybe it was more exhausting. I don't know. Yeah, that's right. Where dating has, in fact, been gamified. So I feel like there's even less of a distinction between those two things, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I want to ask you about Living Games, because you were a big part of organizing it last time. And you're going to be a big part of organizing it in 2018.
Hooray!
Yay! Yeah. So, let's see. What can you tell us about the second or third, I guess, iteration?
Yeah. So, it's in the forming stages right now. Mm-hmm. But I live in Massachusetts in the United States, and it has been held in New York City and in Texas. Mm-hmm. And we have a very large LARPing community in the new northeastern region, say. So I thought that this would be a good place to bring it. We're hoping it'll go every 2 years from now till whenever. It's sort of created in the image of things like the Nutpunkt or Nodal Point series of conferences, which are held in Finland, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. Every year, they're a wonderful set of events where people go and they talk about play, mostly live action games. But there's some tabletop play. But it creates community, brings people together from many countries. Each of them has a week in whatever city they're near, whatever major city in that country, so people can do a little bit of cultural exploration and also relaxed meetups to get to know people before you're actually at the conference and have a longer period of time to get to know people. So it builds some really great long-term relationships and collaborations. And so we were able to do that last year in Texas. And thanks to an amazing group of folks who created it, Sarah Lynn Bowman and Ashley Zeb, particularly put their heart and soul into that. This year I spoke with the New England Interactive Literature. They're a group that's been hosting LARP events over 25 years in the eastern region. The Intercon is held outside of Boston every year. Really fun theater-style LARP. Oh, so terrible with all the categorizations.
It's the Intercon style of LARP, really. Yeah. Like, it truly is its own. Yeah.
People write original LARPs every year. They're usually 4 hour, or some a little longer, some a little shorter, but they're one shots primarily. Sometimes they're in series. Like, there's this wonderful series of the Batman, all Batman games. Everyone comes playing a version of Batman.
They're all Batman.
Yeah, all of them are Batman. And so there's the Batman game, the all Batman game, and then the other all Batman game, and then the other all Batman game. anyway, that's one of the events that they host, and they've been doing it for a long time. So I was very grateful that they were willing to partner and be the hosting entity in Northeast. And so we're working on the specifics right now. It's just formulating. We don't even have a date or a site yet, but we're working on that right now. But I'm very excited to be able to be part of carrying the torch for this. There's a lot of people who play LARPs in the United States, mm-hmm. many, like over many decades. The MIT Assassin's Guild has a long heritage. There are many Mind's Eye Theater communities. And then there's a real blossoming of various communities right now, various different franchise LARPs, and older ones and newer ones, and some blockbuster LARPs like New World Magic School that have, you know, they're bringing in people who wouldn't even have known about LARP, but it's sort of, you know, having this accessible premise where your wizards, much like Harry Potter, it's the kind of thing that people can imagine themselves doing. Dystopia Rising has this post-apocalyptic feel that's very accessible. So in a lot of ways, even though I'm not, I think my home community is tabletop roleplay. So I'm not, I feel like I'm dipping in whenever I'm doing LARP. Although I guess at this point it's kind of sad. Yeah.
At this point, you're kind of one of the world experts on LARP there, Emily.
So. Oh, gosh darn it. All right. Well, all right. Updating sense of self. Here we go. and thank you. That's very complimentary. So anyway, doing it here will be a lot of fun. There's just so many different interesting things going on in the Northeast, and I'm really excited to connect with different related strains of narrative play. Interactive theater is like very, I don't know, there's a lot of groups doing it in both Boston and New York, and so I've met some folks who are interested in collaborating. Sharan Biswas is somebody I'm talking to. We might even run something at an interactive theater festival in New York this year together in the arms of the pack. But, you know, who knows if that'll happen. But it'd be fun. And I'm thinking that maybe I'll go to that festival, even if the bid we do doesn't go, just to meet people and see. Because totally. The world of theater and LARP, they're like parallel, right?
Yeah.
And when I first got excited about LARP, I started exploring improv, and it's a very different form, but there's just a lot of ways that people who are doing those different forms can learn from one another. So I'm hoping that Living Games, along with being a crossroads for people from this country and others who are interested in and love LARP and other narrative play, but also can be an open door for us to connect with other communities. I was thinking about the spoken word community too, slams and poetry performances. That's actually a strong movement, and it'd be wonderful if we could connect with folks who are doing that and see what the overlaps are, you know, what each of us can bring to one another.
Yeah, storytellers, right? We exactly. have a lot of storytellers in Canada. I don't know. I feel like that must be a Massachusetts thing, too.
I know of some storytellers. There's a lot of poetry readings and like, poetry performances. And, again, these are communities that I only have glancing connection with. So as we put together the team to coordinate Living Games in the Boston area in 2018, hoping to make more connections with folks from other communities so they can help us, you know, figure out what it is that we offer, learn how we can communicate with people who are not people we're already talking to, and also really look at how we can provide ways to break down barriers. You know, there's a lot of folks who like games and role-playing games and LARP, and there's a lot of people who we're not serving or not interacting with. So one of the first groups that I'm convening is a inclusivity and accessibility group that will consult with each of the org teams so we can, you know, we're not going to be perfect, we're not going to hit everything, but so that we can just open our eyes a little bit, maybe open that door wider.
That's interesting. So I have raved about the last Living Games, like about 2016 Living Games here on the show many times. So our listeners know what I loved about it or would like to see again or what I appreciated about it. What came out of the 2016 Living Games that you thought, oh, that's great, I want to make that happen again?
I think one of the best things was how excited people were about the people they met there. And just... it was so many wonderful strands of thinkers and players and designers who got to play and talk and just enjoy what each other brought. And the theme last year was sharing insights, and I think that really came through. Something that I would really like for us to focus on this year is sustainable and professional engagement in LARP, right livelihood. because there are a lot of people doing it professionally or people who aspire to. And what I'd like to have us do is to bring in resources for people to learn about, all right, if you want to do a Kickstarter to publish your game, what's that about? How can you do it well? If you want to connect with people who can help you create it as a business. There was a track of that last year, and I want to strengthen that and maybe even have part of the event focus around it, like a little sustainable LARP living fair. Because particularly in the world that we're living in right now, talk about worlds changing, 2016 to 2017 is a very different world in the U.S. And I want to have us, someone pointed this out to me, that we're artists, we're an artist community, and art is so critical. Voices being able to speak out and engage and change minds and express, you know, whether it's resistance or creativity or continuity, we as a community, or rather, we as a bunch of mass communities, it's not monolithic in the slightest.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
This is an opportunity to provide everybody a moment to step in and see who those other communities are, and also to see how we can encourage and support one another in engaging, because it's transformative. Like, some of the stuff that we do does change minds and hearts and does open eyes and does have an ability to work outside of the corporate mainstream and reach people. And let's see, there's a really interesting group in Boston out of Emerson College called the Engagement Lab, and they do civic engagement games.
Yeah.
Which would be, you know, sort of on a different scale than a lot of the games we're thinking about, but maybe a game that helps people learn about voting, where they can register to vote in their town, or, you know, what's going on in terms of water protection. So I'm hoping that we can connect with those folks and just be creative about how we can help people who are coming to Living Games learn about other ways that we can engage in our play. How can we enrich not only our lives, but the community around us? And I think many people who do this stuff give back in their lives and engage in ways that are mindful and thoughtful of the larger community and communities on the planet. So I'm hoping that's one of the things that I'd really like for us to be able to support, and just, you know, give people access to experts and also each other to be able to make those things happen.
Well, you've preempted my new stock question of how do your games fight fascism?
Oh, that's perfect. I heard you're doing that. I'm so excited about that. Thank you for asking that question.
It's very, very important, really.
Can I answer it anyway?
Yeah, hit me.
Because I heard you were asking that question, and then we talked about doing this interview, mm-hmm. So I've been thinking about that.
Oh, that's good.
So just for my games, mm-hmm. Rather than Living Games in general, but I think one of the main things that I try to remember and to engage with is to create games that create empathy in players or give them experiences that invite them to have empathy for people who may not be like them and for themselves. And I think that's one of the biggest ways that fear and hatred flourish, is when we don't have empathy, both for ourselves and for others, because it seems like the moments when people shut down in fear and pain are the moments when we do the most damage to one another. And if we can open up instead, or be okay with the pain and then keep walking through and remember that the person who's hurting us either needs to get out of our space because they're hurting us and we need to be safe, or we are safe and we can allow there to be space for us to communicate through it. Or look at the systems around us and see how they're hurting everybody.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the ways that I hope that what I do helps to fight fascism.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, all of those possibilities that you described, they all require you to be grounded and to be present in what you're feeling, regardless of what the response might be. I think a lot of people are afraid to feel certain things. And I wonder if just having really intense emotional experiences all the time for fun might help with that a tiny bit. You just learn that it's not the worst thing in the world to feel really hurt or to feel really scared or really sad, because you can just make that happen if you wanted to. Oh, I think about that a lot.
Yeah. I mean, we simulate so many things in games, you know. We were talking about sparring before. That's simulation. That's play. It's being able to get kicked in the head with your friend so you can feel safe the first time it happens. And then the second time, it's like, okay, I lived through that. I can ground, I can center here and keep moving through.
You're right, which is the whole point of sparring, right? It is play as conditioning and play as like learning and getting comfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. LARP. It's exactly like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. That's my summary of that point. Well, Emily, tell me, what do you, besides living games, what are you excited about for the future? What are you working on right now that you're like, oh man, cannot wait to share this?
Okay. One of the things that I'm very excited about right now is a series of edu-LARP style games that I'm working on. Mm. I wrote and ran one last year at Intercon that was about John Milton and Paradise Lost, that used a sort of mini games to introduce people to about a semester's worth of English history. and then play through bits of this great poet's life, mm-hmm. and this work, which is very influential in English literature, but is very like impenetrable, mm-hmm. and a little bit rejected, or, you know, it's been embraced and rejected at different times. And I was really excited about it because Milton as a figure cuts across many different time periods in European history, and unites different strands from different parts of the world and philosophy and thought and theology. And some of his work is the basis upon which we have the Constitution and the idea of civil rights. And so being able to create a structured experience where people could engage with that was a lot of fun, and people did great things with it. And so this year I've worked on a game that is based on another author, actually several authors, Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, and the sort of famous summer at Lake Geneva where she spent with Percy Bysshe Shelley and Lord Byron and two other wonderful but lesser known figures, Claire Claremont and John Polidori, and collaborating with the inimitable Ken Haidt on this, it's an area and a period that he's had great interest in over the years. So we're hoping to create a book that is just a background and introduction to these writers and to their period and to the ideals of Romanticism and the moment in time that that was, another moment of industrialization and great change, and that sort of underlies a lot of the values that we have today, like liberalism, being able to throw off the yoke of monarchy, and Percy Bysshe Shelley was a pacifist, they were vegetarians, a lot of really interesting stuff, and then just play a very short game. It's only 2 or 3 hours that you play, and you can just get a little piece of these players, these characters' lives in this emotional point. And I got to run that at Intercon, although I ran it at midnight twice in a row, which was totally appropriate and totally tiring. and I'm still tweaking it. Got a lot of really good input from those players. They did a fantastic job. They brought great things to those characters. And I think it'll be stronger from the feedback that they gave me. So, and next year I've already bid a game about Jane Austen. and I might write that so that it's bringing Jane Austen and Shakespeare side by side. Because one of the things that's a little frustrating is... both Jane Austen and Shakespeare, in different ways, are incredibly influential to our contemporary fiction. They're interpreted over and over again. They're alive in our world of fiction right now. But although Jane Austen obviously is highly regarded, I think there's a little bit of a high culture around Shakespeare versus, okay, well, there's Jane Austen too.
Yeah.
So I would want to, one idea about this game would be to call it, or to do a version of it called the Two Bards, mm-hmm. and have them interact, or have people maybe have, like, it'd be awesome to have, you know, Lady Macbeth interacting with Elizabeth Bennet. But we'll see where that lands. It might just be focusing really on Jane Austen as a person. And there's a lot we don't know about her. So it'd be neat to be able to give people space to play with what she might have been like, given that we have all of her stories. And they're so clearly reflective of her life, even though they're not autobiographical. So anyway, that's a whole set of games that I'm very excited about. And they're fun to write, they're fun to research, fun to play, and I really want to have some collaborations grow where I work with educators who can help me create them as curriculum pieces. So that a class, you know, maybe a class in college that's taking a semester on Milton could do as a one credit extra seminar or honor seminar or something where people get together for a few sessions and then play this game. The same with the others, or, you know, whatever context makes sense to plug them in.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be my next question is, how do people engage with this stuff? Like, if they can't go to Intercon, would these things be available to them, or?
Well, something that's happened the Romance Trilogy totally exemplifies in my writing is that I seem to not be able to stop writing. So I keep making different versions of things. Mm-hmm. There's actually two versions of the Mary Shelley one, which is called The Dare, and one that just deals with Frankenstein and one that interweaves the other pieces of work that were written at that week, that summer. So I think I'd like to have different versions available. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to have ones that are written specifically for a curriculum so that they'd be appropriate or accessible for educators. And then also I want to have shorter versions, simpler versions, so that people can play them. The Dare, right how it's written now, it's written as a pickup game, so that you do a little mini game with like whist cards. Ken's idea, wonderful. that have trivia about the characters, and you play that, and that just gives you a jump into the game. And actually, at Intercon, they didn't need that because they had the context where they had the materials for weeks beforehand. They were players who were so deeply engaged that they did tremendous preparation. One player of Mary Shelley on the Friday night game actually memorized the introduction to Frankenstein. He gave that as a monologue.
Oh my gosh, amazing.
Oh my God, stunning, stunning, stunning. So, but it, you know, they didn't need that whist game. It didn't have, you know, as much effect. So I'm learning about what people would like. So right now, Darkness Visible, which is the John Milton game, is available in the sort of a documentation form on my website, blackgreengames.com, all the other games, on the game design page, which has a bunch of either free games I've made that are in development or that are done, but that I'm not publishing per se. So it's there. And I'll probably have a playtest version of The Dare available at some point. I'm going to revise it now that I've gotten to run it a few times. And I'll do the same with the Jane Austen game, which right now is called With So Fine a Brush. And eventually I would like to make them available for sale too. If all things come together, we'll do a Kickstarter for The Dare. And,
your next trilogy.
Oh, gosh. Oh, so true.
It's not a command, it's a prediction. I have seen it.
I have another game about Chinese history. There's a whole bunch of games that I really love history. History and literature are two of my mm-hmm. go-tos for design. And I'll just become obsessed with a period and read everything I can. And then sometime, it can be a year later or 20 years later, I'll go, oh, there's a game there.
Yeah. I'm actually very excited by Kingway's Tower. And I'm kind of like not pushily wondering if it will be done. It's like the fall of the king?
The Qin.
Qin Dynasty, which is very interesting to me for a bunch of reasons. I think I was researching something else and then fell into like a Wikipedia hole or something and was like, oh, this is so interesting. And I looked around and there weren't that many Wuxia movies about it. So now I'm like, well, I have to find some other way to interact with that period of history. So do you think we'll be seeing a finished version of King Wei's Tower at some point?
Yes, definitely. That game is completely done design-wise. I am looking for a way to create it as a finished product that is culturally respectful. I want to find a collaborator to work on with that is knowledgeable and work with folks from China who I can make sure that as I write it, because I'm not tying it to be you play out the historical events exactly as they are, but I want to make sure that I'm understanding them and not overlaying solely my Northeastern American interpretation of the,
of course,
events. And I am going to change the genders of the characters. So it's kind of like running, the American Revolution, where George Washington is a woman, which actually I kind of want to write that game.
incidentally.
but I did that very intentionally because I wanted to make it gender progressive. And feeling to me like it feels like it fits in the Wuxia genre, but I can't. I don't feel like I comfortably can publish that game until I have other collaborators that I'm working on. And just like the romance trilogy has a commitment to benefit to charities that I love and feel strongly about, Shanti Bhavan, which helps Dalit children in India. Just changes their lives. And then Nelkquit, which is a resource for women and children and people in crisis in my hometown and county. I want to have the same component where it whatever, I don't think it'll be like, the next D&D, but whatever money comes from it, I want it to get back to communities that it draws from. So yeah, absolutely. But the version that's, I think there's a free version on my website, and it's playable. I probably should go back and refine it a bit, but unlike some games where I'm still like tweaking the mechanics, that one, that's not the problem. It's more, I just want to make sure that it's a culturally responsible design in its final product.
Well, that's really interesting. It sounds like you have tons of irons in the fire and not in a bad way.
One wonderful thing about Living Games, because I've made this commitment to chair it, is that I am really feeling strong permission to say no to new commitments.
Ah, that would be cool. That would be interesting.
For you and many of your viewers can relate, it's very difficult to say no. And I feel like it's sort of cleared the decks. And the only things I'm committing to this year are things that I feel like are contained, that will fit within that broader whatever that I'm going to do. And that means so much to me that it's worth it. And that, speaking of therapy, definitely one of those things I've struggled with over the years to try and be able to have a manageable life. And and also last year working on both the romance trilogy and having to write and run Darkness Visible, which is the Milton game, which was, even though I had been doing the research for that game for years, actually to write it was a bear. Oh my God. So I got sick last year and I just had a real wake up call that cannot, like I'm 45. Come on. I'm glad I'm not in my 20s anymore, but I am in my 40s. So
it's nice when your body just kind of reminds you eventually, when your body's like, you probably shouldn't do that. You probably shouldn't do that. And then it's like, well, here we are. You're like, you were right. Yeah, it's good to have that information sometimes.
Thank you, body, for your wisdom. Yes.
Yeah, stop. Yeah, exactly.
I will sleep now.
Your most unpleasant and unwelcome wisdom. well, that seems like a lovely note to end on. If my listeners want to keep up with you and your projects and what you're doing, where should they go?
Blackgreengames.com. My company name is Black and Green Games. I do have a Patreon, which I used to support, and thank you so much for the wonderful backers for the Romance Trilogy. I don't have anything for it right now, but there may be projects in the future, and there's links at my website there. And yeah, check it out. Love to see anybody or talk to people, and hopefully I'll get to play with a lot of folks at conventions over the years. Maybe yeah, living yeah. games.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. I'll bring a whole backstory contingent. Don't worry about it.
Awesome. At livinggamesconference.com, the information there is all about last year, but there's a link that you can sign up for updates and news. And anybody who's interested in like hearing about when the date's announced or, you know, when registration opens, that kind of thing, just go and plug in your email and then you'll be included and we'll let you know.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening. This was lovely.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was a real pleasure.
Yay.
Thanks again to Emily for joining us this week. And as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on this week's episode, you can send Alex an email at backstorypodcast@gmail.com. Or you can tweet at her at BackstoryCast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows, including some featuring Emily's work, at oneshotpodcast.com. Backstory's music is provided by Yujiko. This particular track is called Thinking of You, and you can find more at soundcloud.com/Yujiko. That's UGICO. Talk to you later, heroes.